So one of my supervisors, Roland Maiuro, was doing some sex offender assessments, and so I started doing that work with him. And then after my postdoc, and actually during my postdoc, I was consulting with Western State Hospital and their sex offender program. At that time, I was doing work in anger management, and so we incorporated anger management into sex offender treatment, and so they were interested in that. And so I got a job at Western State Hospital in 1983, and part of that was an effort to stay in Seattle and with my community. And so when I went to Seattle, I just, you know, I became active in the Japanese Presbyterian Church again, and my wife did too, and so we had this really supportive community. The clinical work and the research I was doing had, there was no cultural component to it, and actually in these, among the sex offenders that I treated clinically and studied, there were, you know, out of hundreds of sex offenders, there was maybe one Asian American man. So, I mean, it wasn't on my radar. I mean, I still was interested in these issues, but there was, it didn't seem like there was an opportunity to integrate cultural interests with sexual aggression or sex offender work. Just in part because, you know, there were hardly any Asian American sex offenders. 90% of my job was to assess and treat these sex offenders, and then I had 10% research time. And so what was a great opportunity there is that they had a lot of, they had all this MMPI data on sex offenders, and we had, they were also collecting physiological data on sexual arousal, and so that data was available. And no one was doing research at the time, and so I had this 10% research time that I had negotiated, and so I was able to conduct several studies, personality, psychopathology studies, as well as studies of sexual arousal. And so this, you know, offered an opportunity to collect lots of data because it was a large hospital and there were many sex offenders who were being assessed and treated there. And then there was a large archive of data as well. So.
And with all that, a lot of data, if I remember, it wasn't very predictive of much.
No, there weren't, you know, so at that time, there was a belief that there were certain profiles that were, I guess, characteristic of sex offenders, of sexually abused children versus men who sexually abused adults. And there really weren't, I mean, there were multiple profiles, and there wasn't a single profile that was more common than others. I mean, there's certain patterns of elevations on the MMPI, but basically this kind of exploded the idea that you can, you know, if a person has this kind of profile, they're a sex offender. And also the physiological work was similar. So we were using what's called a penile plethysmograph, which is a measure of sexual arousal to different visual or audio stimuli describing sexually aggressive experiences, consenting experiences. And it turned out that some men were just more arousable than others. And so if someone is arousable, they're going to be aroused no matter what you present to them. And so this measure wasn't very good at distinguishing who was and who wasn't a sex offender. So the intervention was to, their behavioral interventions to reduce the arousal to, you know, the arousal to children or something aggressive. But that was only part of the picture, because some of these men were aroused by everything, or some men weren't aroused by anything, and that, you know, and they still were sex offenders, arousal or not. And so both with the MMPI and with these sexual arousal studies, I think we brought a critical eye to these standard methods that were are considered by some as kind of definitive proof that a person was or wasn't a sex offender.